Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Previously in episode one of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Unknown Subject.
Walking up to the body, it became apparent that there had been a sexual assault, and by the way her clothes were disarrayed, and that she had was deceased.
I didn't know anything was wrong until her mom called me and said, I can't get in touch with Christine. She's not answering her phone. Have you heard from her?
It was pretty apparent, right away that there had been a sexual assault. And her entire head was just crushed.
The moment I heard that voice on the intercom, I broke down crying because to me that meant that, okay, something really bad has happened.
He had to have been covered in blood, because I was always like, how did he get away?
At one point, they had thought that they had identified the perpetrator, and they were completely convinced, but the DNA didn't match.
7 years and 8 months before Christine Mirzayan was murdered in Washington, D.C., a 32-year-old woman returning from a business trip was attacked inside her home in suburban Montgomery County, Maryland, in a subdivision called Washingtonian Woods, a community of 3- and 4-bedroom Dutch and Cape Cod-style homes spread across rolling acres of land that at one time was a golf course. It's about 20 miles north of where Christine was killed.
She was away. She lived by herself. She was away on a business trip for a couple of days. And when she came home from her business trip, she drove up into the driveway, walked up the steps into her house. And as soon as she got to the top of the steps, there was a person just immediately threw a blanket over their head. And looking at the initial scene at the house, he had taken a chair from the dining room and put it right in front of a picture window overlooking the driveway. So he had been sitting there, no one knows how long, just waiting for this woman to come home. So he had pre-selected her and was just going to wait for her as long as it took.
That's Montgomery County, Maryland Police Detective Joe Madonna. In 1991, he had been on the force for 10 years. He's retired now, living in Florida. In the fall of 2020, I asked him to tell me about a case that had stumped him for years. We talked via Zoom.
Let's just go back over that May 6, 1991 incident again. Tell me exactly what he did.
He put the blanket over, threw the blanket over her head immediately, and he raped her. He didn't physically beat her up or anything. She didn't really resist that much, as we found out. As these cases went on, the more the victims resisted, the more violent he became. And if they submitted, he did not, aside from raping them, which is, obviously bad, but he didn't physically injure them.
The rapist bound the woman's hands with a phone cord and held something sharp against her side. Before he fled, he stole her purse, which had $80 inside.
How did he get into the house?
There was no sign of forced entry anywhere. But he did get in, looks like in the basement, because we did find muddy footprints in the basement. But all the windows and the doors were closed and locked. So she had just, this house was just built, and there was still construction going on in the neighborhood. So we went back to the builder with this case to find out who might have had a key while the house was still under construction. And came up with a dead end with that too. So we couldn't find a forced entry. She might have forgot to lock a basement door, but it was in the basement that he came in. So that's where we saw the footprints coming in.
And then how long would these attacks last? At least in this one.
This one, I think it was pretty short. 10, 15 minutes. Other ones lasted longer.
Did he say anything to her?
No, that, I can't recall that off the top of my head. And she did not go into a lot of detail because she did not really want this investigated.
In fact, Madonna says the woman did not go to the hospital and was not examined by a SANE nurse. SANE is an acronym for Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, a nurse who specializes in the forensic care of a patient who's been sexually assaulted. So there was no DNA. And since the woman had not gotten a look at the man's face, there was no composite sketch, so nothing to put on a flyer and pass around the neighborhood. Instead, the investigation focused on that one solid lead, the rapist's ghoulish M.O. This was a man who apparently had access to information. Otherwise, how would he have known to be waiting inside the house? How did he know she'd be coming home from her trip that day? And he waited by that window, maybe for hours, for his victim to return home. Throughout that summer, Detective Madonna and others worked the case. He had a hunch. Washingtonian Woods was still a fairly new development, and there was still construction going on. He wondered if the attacker worked in the neighborhood. That would allow him the perfect opportunity to keep watch on who was coming and going, to look for victims. Madonna subpoenaed lists from all of the different home builders of all the different workers and contractors and subcontractors and electricians. Detectives were trying to cross-reference the list for criminal records. It was literally thousands of names long, and police didn't have the kind of high-tech software in the early 90s to sort through it all. With that case going nowhere, Joe Madonna was left wondering where he would turn to next. The answer came in a late-night phone call about 4 months later. A teenage babysitter had just been attacked inside a home about 6 miles from where the first assault took place. And the rapist's M.O. was nearly identical to the other case. He waited under a sheet, disguised almost like a chair, then jumped up and attacked the teen, with the kids she was watching still upstairs in bed. I'm Paul Wagner, and this is Kelly's Story, Episode 2 of Unknown Subject.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
I'm Paul Wagner. In this episode, you're going to hear about a lot of violent, frightening assaults that took place throughout the 90s, all in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's the largest county in the state, with a population in 1990 of more than 750,000 people. Montgomery County borders Washington, D.C. to the south, and Prince George's County to the east. Many of these attacks you're going to hear about took place in new, pricey subdivisions that were then popping up across the country. $500,000 homes in cul-de-sacs carved out of the woods, some not too far from the banks of the Potomac River as it twists its way from West Virginia into Maryland. You already know about the link between these attacks and Christine's murder. But that's something investigators didn't know in the early 90s. They couldn't know that. Remember, these attacks happened before Christine's killing. Back in 1991, all detectives knew for certain is that they were dealing with a rapist who had a chilling M.O., who seemed to strike at random. It's September of that year, 1991. A few days after Labor Day, in a home in another housing development near Germantown, Maryland. It's a Thursday, and the couple who owned the home were out for the night. A babysitter, an 18-year-old woman who had just started her first year of college, is inside. Her boyfriend had just stopped by for a visit and left. She was alone. Here's Detective Joe Madonna.
When she went to put the kids to bed, she came back into the family room, which has access through the garage. The garage door opens into the family room. And at first she thought it was just like a sheet, like thrown over a chair, something to that effect. That's what her initial thought was. But then before she could realize anything else, she just jumped up under the sheet and just threw it right over her head.
Oh, that's frightening.
Yeah, it is.
So he's hiding in on a chair with a sheet over his head, and she...
No. It looked like he was acting as a chair. She thought it was a chair with a sheet over it. You know, if you squat down, maybe have your arms out. That was the appearance. That's what it looked like to her. And as soon as she got past it, that's when he jumped up and threw it over her head.
Oh, that's freaky.
It is freaky.
And so what did you learn from that case?
Well, in that case, we know that he cut the phone lines to the house.
Wow.
So we found that from the outside, the phone lines were cut. And he gained entry through the garage, looks like through a garage window. And the door leading from the garage into the family room was unlocked. So, but as he was raping her, he was talking to her calmly. Like, you know, how come your boyfriend didn't do this with you while he was here? So that tells you that he was sitting there watching her for quite a while, probably waiting for the boyfriend to leave.
He knew that, you know, I was there, and he knew there were children there. And I just remember saying, don't, you know, wake the babies, don't hurt the babies. He had taken phone cords and tied me like behind my back with my ankles. So he had pulled my shirt up over my head.
That's Kelly, the babysitter, from a June 2017 NBC Washington story with reporter Darcy Spencer. At that time, 26 years after she was attacked, Kelly's case remained unsolved. Investigators had made some progress in the case, which I'll tell you about later, but they were still unable to unravel the riddle of the unknown subject. Frustrated with the lack of progress in the case, Kelly bravely came forward in hopes of telling her story and bringing new attention to the investigation. It was something she did on her own with no urging from the police. When I came across that story while doing research for this podcast, I wondered if Kelly would be willing to talk to me. So I reached out to Darcy Spencer, the reporter who first interviewed her. Kelly agreed to talk with me if her last name could be kept confidential and if Darcy could be part of the interview.
Darcy just arrived.
Okay.
Wanna say hi?
Hey!
I was still conducting most of my interviews outside because of COVID. On this day, Darcy and I were in the parking lot of a Kensington, Maryland train station. We were both next to the lift gate of my Ford Escape, and I had my laptop set up on a box so Darcy and I could both see the screen. Kelly was joining us on Zoom. You will hear some noises from a nearby construction site and an approaching train. It was not ideal, but we made it work, with Darcy and I passing the microphone back and forth while standing behind the car. First, for perspective, you need to hear why Kelly decided to tell her story and show her face on local TV.
Because I don't live in the area, you know, we just felt like we don't hear much anyway, but we've been following the news and we just knew that we just wanted to try to get it out there again. And so I don't know. I honestly think it was my husband's idea. And I don't recall exactly how we found Darcy.
I was actually very honored in the fact that I would get to do the interview with Kelly, the very first interview, breaking her silence after so many years of dealing with this personal pain and trauma.
This is Darcy.
And I did speak to her on the phone. We had multiple communications before I actually met her in person. I wanted to make sure that she knew me a little bit and that she was comfortable and she felt like I would be the person to do a good job sharing her story with the community for the very first time. She knows a lot of people here in the Washington, D.C. area, having grown up in the area. So there are going to be people who would see her on TV and recognize her face, even though we didn't give her name. So I knew that this was going to be a brave person that I was going to be talking to. It takes a lot of courage to come forward after having been a victim of a serial rapist. I just couldn't imagine. And it was really wonderful to meet her in person. Like I said, I got a sense of who she was just from speaking to her ahead of time. But just to meet her in person, to be in her presence, I thought it was very special, and I really wanted to be sensitive as possible, because even though this happened a long time ago, when you experience trauma like that, it never goes away. And to talk about very personal things like this, it takes a lot of strength. So I was really honored to meet her and to be able to share her story.
You know, I have a really good family. I've always had a great support system throughout this entire process. And I just felt like I wanted to get the word out. I wanted to bring awareness. I wanted to show, my biggest thing is to show other women in particular, but just people in general, that you can get through these type of situations. I was the youngest victim. So, you know, at 18, I literally had just turned 18 years old.
On September 4th, 1991, a Thursday, Kelly left her home in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and drove a few miles north to a new housing development in Germantown. She'd been there before, perhaps as many as a dozen times. She knew the family well, knew the layout of the house. A beautiful, at the time, $500,000 home sitting on a large plot of land. Watkins Meadow is a leafy suburban cul-de-sac on the edge of the great Seneca Stream Valley Park. It was out in the country, a few large homes on a winding lane surrounded by a forest of trees. It was remote. With Mike, her husband, by her side, Kelly, who's now in her late 40s, recounts the most terrifying night of her life.
I'm always like, where do I get started? So, yeah, I was sitting on the couch watching TV, and I saw the homeowner's house had a garage door. So I saw the garage door cracked, and I just thought it was the homeowner coming home, you know, because that's how they would come in and out of their house. So I just sort of didn't do anything right away.
Hold on, we got a train coming by.
Yeah.
This is probably a freight, so it might take a minute.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, geez. What COVID has done to us all. Jeez.
Just tell me when you're ready, when it quiets down.
Still waiting for the train.
Gosh, it came at the very worst moment.
Well. Okay, the train's gone by. All right, so if you want to pick it up from seeing the garage door.
Okay, so the garage door open was, it was cracked, and that's usually where the homeowners would come in. So I didn't do anything right away. I just kind of sat there. I was watching TV at the same time as sort of studying. So after like a minute passes, I was like, why didn't they come in the door? So I got up and walked to the open doorway. And I guess it was him standing behind the door watching me for that minute or so. And so when I stood up to walk to the doorway, he jumped into the door with a blanket and threw it over my head. And then I fell back to the ground and hit my head on the ground. And then I don't know if I lost consciousness or just confused, you know, from hitting my head. But basically, I just remember feeling him pick me up off the ground. I had this blanket over my head. And then the next thing I remember, I was laying on my stomach on their living room floor. And he had sort of hogtied me, I guess, with my wrist and my ankles tied behind me. So I was just laying on the floor, not really knowing exactly what was going on. He took the blanket off of me and pulled my shirt up over my head. And that's pretty much it. And then he proceeded to rape me. Not a whole lot of communication. You know, I was just sort of crying and please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt. The homeowners had three small children. They were all upstairs sleeping at the time. So I just remember saying, you know, please don't wake the children. Please don't hurt the children. You know, things like that.
Gosh, how incredibly frightening. And we know from other victims that he'd stayed around for a period of time, either spying on people beforehand or staying around afterward. And yeah, how long did he stay?
Well, and I sort of skipped that part, but prior to him actually breaking into the house, I had been just studying in the house and I had forgotten a book in my car. And so I did walk out of the house before this happened and to get a book in out of my car. And I did have a feeling like someone was watching me. And I remember looking up and looking out into the wooded area that was behind the house and just felt like someone was watching me. And so I hurried up and got my book and went back into the house and locked the door. And, you know, just that off feeling when you feel like something's not right, but you don't really know exactly what it is.
There are other disturbing details that stand out. While he had her pinned down, she described her rapist almost taunting her, asking Kelly why she hadn't been intimate with her boyfriend, who had visited earlier that night, meaning he'd been watching her that whole time. And what happened after he assaulted her is also chilling.
After he raped me, I just was laying on the floor, and he did get up, and a lot of the common areas of the house were either hardwood floor or tile, so I could hear his footsteps walking around the house, and I heard
While
him.
You're laying there tied up, you could hear him going around the house. You must have been so frightened for the kids.
Yeah, I mean, you just don't know what he's doing, you know, but I could hear him. The kids were upstairs and I knew he was on the same floor as me. He went into the kitchen. He actually went into the refrigerator, got a can of soda, opened the can of soda, drank it, I imagine, but I heard the like pop of a can opening. And in my mind, I'm just like, thinking, you know, he's gonna come back for me. And I, you know, I just didn't know. So you just hear his feet. And I just remember, you know, I am a really strong in my faith. And I just was like, just sort of like praying and just quietly, just please God, what do I do? What do I do? And I just felt like God just told me go. And I literally broke. I was wrapped up after the fact, I found out I was wrapped up with phone cords like around my wrist and ankle. That's how he tied me up with the phone cord. So when I just felt like God said, go, I just broke. He was in the house, but you're just in that moment where you don't know what's gonna happen. And I got up, broke free, got up, ran to the front door. I saw a jogger who was running down the street, but the home that they lived in had a deadbolt with a key. And they didn't have the key in it, so I couldn't get out the front door. So I saw the jogger, I turned around, I ran upstairs to the master bedroom, and I opened the window and started yelling out the master bedroom for help. All while he is still in the house. I have no idea what he was doing.
Did the jogger hear you?
Yes, the jogger heard me. I guess I scared him. I don't know, but he didn't come to help me. He ran home and called the police, at least thankfully. But he didn't come to help me. But it was just one of those weird things that you just have like that feeling and that gut intuition. I always tell people trust your gut, because I just felt like I needed to run, and I ran, and I guess I didn't know what I potentially was running into, but I'm glad I did it, because I don't know if he would have come back and done anything else to me.
Kelly told me she wanted to get away from the house where she had been attacked as quickly as possible. But the couple she was babysitting for were out on a date and were late coming home. The police stayed there with her, but Kelly says they didn't want her to leave the house to go to the hospital until the homeowners returned in case one of the three kids woke up. When the couple finally showed up, Kelly remembers the husband was belligerently drunk and not very understanding or compassionate about the ordeal she had survived. When the police were there, Kelly said she even remembers a neighbor stopping by and overhearing him make comments to police about seeing her boyfriend's car there that night, as if she were somehow responsible for what happened to her. It's hard to make sense of now, but the 1990s were a different time. Remember, the first victim didn't even want to go to the hospital after she was attacked. Finally, about 2 a.m., the police took her to the emergency room where a sane nurse would examine her for evidence that would then be placed in a rape kit. Kelly never saw the face of the man who raped her, but unlike the first case, investigators would obtain DNA that could point to Kelly's attacker. But in 1991, DNA wasn't the first thing investigators were thinking of. That would come much later. It's August 3rd, 2021, and I'm standing outside the house where Kelly was attacked back in September of 1991. I wanted to come up here and see this place for myself. It's a rural area. The homes are very large, and they sit on large parcels of land. I would estimate 2 acres each at least. This cul-de-sac sits off a country lane not far from a main road, which would lead back to I-270, which is the main highway that comes up here through Montgomery County. Kelly says the man who attacked her came in through the garage, and the garage sits to the right of the house as I look at it. And there's a driveway that goes uphill about 50 yards. And the house, as I mentioned, these houses are sitting on large parcels of land. There's large areas of open space around this house, but there's also a tree line on both sides, and I can imagine that it would be an attractive place for somebody to hide as they lie in wait for an attack. Kelly has said that when she came out to get a book while she was babysitting, she had this eerie feeling that she was being watched. As I mentioned, this is a rural area, so it's not like somebody just walked off the street. You'd have to park a car somewhere. And so this is a place you'd have to drive to. It's not like you could just walk through a neighborhood to, you know, get to this location. As I stand here in the afternoon, I've noticed how quiet it is, so I can imagine how quiet it must have been that night. It was about 10 or 10:30 at night when Kelly was attacked, and she was able to break free and then go up to the master bedroom and open the window and yell out to a passing jogger. Detective Joe Madonna told me one of the things that bothered him the most about these attacks is he could never figure out how the rapist was picking his victims. And when you stand here in this neighborhood where Kelly was attacked, you can imagine all the things that would go through your mind as to what would have brought him into this neighborhood. What kind of a job would have brought him into this neighborhood? Or did he perhaps follow someone from a store and see where they went? Although that's hard to imagine here on this cul-de-sac, because if you were being followed, you'd notice a car coming behind you. Since I've been here in the last half hour, not one car has driven by. There's all sorts of things that run through your mind. Could he possibly have been working with a landscaping crew, or
Was he a repairman, working as an electrician or a plumber, or did he work for one of the cable companies that brought him into this area? And was he in a position where he was able to scope out the neighborhood and conduct surveillance to see if there was a possible victim that he'd want to choose? And I can just imagine the rapist fleeing at that point, running out of the house, possibly back out the way he came, from the garage, down this driveway, and then out onto this cul-de-sac. But where did he go? Where did he park his car? How did he get away? These are questions that we just don't have the answers to. The days and weeks that followed were very difficult for Kelly. She told me she struggled with nightmares every time she closed her eyes. She had to be tested for HIV, which in the early 90s meant waiting a week for test results to come in. They were negative. She said she had a continuous feeling of being violated over and over again. She felt so vulnerable, and so many things were completely out of her hands. She was just starting her freshman year of college. Every time she noticed a man look at her, she had severe anxiety. She stayed home as much as she could. It took months before she felt like things began to return to some kind of normal. She continued seeing a therapist, and even to this day, she says, the nightmares still come. Not as often, but still there. For police, they were struggling with where the case would go. Kelly never saw how her rapist left the house that night. But when police canvassed the neighborhood afterward, a neighbor reported seeing somebody taking off on a bicycle. And a few doors down, another neighbor reported a bicycle being stolen from their house. It's possible the attacker parked a car out on the main road and took the bicycle out of the cul-de-sac. But police weren't sure. There were a few clues, but even more dead ends. Then, 2 months later, there was a third attack. This one in a townhouse community just off River Road in an area called Potomac Village, a 20-minute drive down the interstate from the house where Kelly was attacked. It would be one of the most bizarre attacks, Joe Madonna said, he ever investigated.
So she's actually in bed, and the next thing she knows, this guy comes bursting. She heard something in the hallway, and she sat up in bed, and the next thing she knows, a guy comes bursting into the room with, I can't remember whether it's a sheet or a pillowcase, but immediately puts it over her head.
That's next in episode 3 of Unknown Subject. Unknown Subject, season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written by me, Paul Wagner, with editorial assistance from Jack Moore, Julia Ziegler, and Craig Schwab. This episode would not be possible without the help of Joe Madonna, Kelly, and Darcy Spencer. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Our show relies on people like you leaving ratings and reviews on Apple to help us climb the podcast charts and attract new listeners. We hope if you like what you hear, you will take a minute to do so. If you have questions or comments about the show, send us an email through our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. We are also on Twitter and Facebook at AM Nightmare Pod. The music in the show is Ethereal Thoughts by Olive Musique and Steadfast by Moments. And as always, thanks for listening.